From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a new web series examines the definition of minority. Then for her movie Boundaries, filmmaker Shauna Feste finds inspiration through her father.
My father looks horrible on paper. In and out of prison, breaking the law, divorces, leaving families behind. But when you sit down and you meet him, and you drink tequila with him, and he tells you these stories, and you see the life in his eyes and his laugh, you don't judge him as harshly.
And a country music trio uses songs to celebrate feminist stories. All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
And National Geographic's Jane, a documentary by Brett Morgan profiling conservationist Jane Goodall using more than 100 hours of lost archival footage. Emmy-eligible in all categories. NatGeoTV.com/FYC.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll start today's show with this. If you picture someone who's a minority right now, there are lots of people who could come to mind, but a few who probably don't, like a Caucasian freshman at a historically black college, an African-American cowboy competing in the predominantly white sport of bull riding, or an all-white, mostly American boy band trying to make it in the South Korean K-pop scene. They are all subjects in a new documentary series called Minority Reports. It debuted this week on Vice.com. The series is hosted by Lee Adams, and he explains the idea behind it.
The important thing for Minority Reports was to start a conversation around those things like race and privilege that are very difficult for people to sort of tangle with and sometimes uncomfortable. But what we hope to do is to at least start the dialogue in a way that's constructive and beneficial for, you know, all parties involved.
I'm going to talk about the first episode. You talk with Tiago Rachelson. He's a white student at Atlanta's Morehouse College, and it's one of about 100 historically black colleges and universities in the U.S. How did you find out about Tiago, and why was his story important to you?
So my brother is actually a graduate of Morehouse College, and my sister went to Spelman College, which is right across the yard. And for me, as soon as I had my first conversation with him, and I heard him describe to me how he feels his calling to dismantle the attitude of whiteness and the privilege that he was born with and acknowledge that privilege. For an 18-year-old, I found that incredibly impressive, and I knew I had to tell his story.
When we first meet him, he tells a little bit about his story. Let's listen to what Tiago has to say about his upbringing.
You know, growing up in predominantly black kindergarten and elementary school, and then transitioning to a more white, affluent community in my high school, you know, you get to see the two different levels. I think it was just psychologically just like, you know, put me into this position where like I'm naturally more gravitated towards the black community than the white community.
It sounds pretty easy, but it's not necessarily so. There's two things that are really happening. One is how he is welcomed by that community. And the other thing is how he feels he is being welcomed. So let's talk first about how he's received by students at Morehouse. It seems like there's two different ways that people look at him.
Yeah, he has found his core group of friends, and they've been accepting. Everyone sort of describes this initial skepticism around his presence on that campus, and they really want to question his motives. The question in everyone's mind, and the question that we have with Minority Reports, was, why is this kid here, and what does he hope to gain from this experience, and what does he hope to bring to it? And over the course of the episode, we are fortunate enough to speak with people who fall on both sides of the line, those who highly question his presence and intention, and those who have experienced his drive to add something to the HBCU experience and hopefully take something away from that community to bring it to others that he can freely navigate that certain members of that HBCU community, those black members, can't as easily navigate in society by virtue of just the color of their skin.
There's something else that happens, and that there's some students who start questioning your presence on campus, that here the school is getting some outside coverage, something intended for your audience, and yet the focus is on one of the white students on campus. What did you make of that criticism of your presence?
I knew as a young Black filmmaker, as a person who has been marginalized in society myself, it was important to me to make sure that we give a voice to this community, because we're not just going to come there and make sure that the only voice that is made relevant to the audience is the white voice. I wanted to make sure that Vice as a company was not going to repeat the mistakes that other mainstream media outlets had in the past, where we traveled to this marginalized community and we champion the one white perspective that exists there.
In the second episode, you go visit rodeo and bull riders in Texas, and it is largely a white and, to a somewhat lesser extent, a Latino sport, and you find a Black bull rider. I'm going to play a little bit of your conversation with Neil Holmes. He was the only African-American ranked in the top 100 professional bull riders in the world.
You're standing on the back of the bucket shoes, and you got a good view of everything that's going on. You're looking around just to find somebody that look like you.
Why?
Because that's just familiar, you know, that's just us as humans. And that's not to pull a race card, I mean, it's the fact the audience that we're attending is, you know, 90% Caucasian.
I always had this fascination with rodeo culture and bull riding culture and cowboy culture at large. And I knew that, you know, Black people in America had a deep history when it comes to the fact that 1/4 of the cowboys in the American West historically were Black, but those stories were largely untold. And when I first spoke to Neil and when I first spoke to Ezekiel Mitchell, who is a rising star in the world of the professional bull riding, I knew I wanted to tell their story as well. They were such dynamic characters who lived such incredible lives and were also trailblazers in their own right. When you see someone that looks like you doing something that couldn't be more foreign than riding a 1,000-pound animal, it makes you take a step back and really reimagine the things that you're capable of or the things that you thought you were once capable of.
What do you hope people take away from your series? What do you hope that they see in terms of looking at issues in a new light?
I hope they disagree with me. I hope they agree with me. I hope they have their own thoughts and opinions of the stories that we tell, and they take those stories and they go back and they talk to their friends about it and maybe reimagine the perspectives that they have, but also make room for perspectives that maybe they didn't think were valuable in the first place.
Lee Adams is the host of Minority Reports. Lee, thanks so much for coming on the show.
John, I appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
You can watch the first episode of Minority Reports now on Vice.com. Coming up, how one filmmaker found inspiration and reconciliation in making a movie about her father.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's series One Strange Rock, hosted by Will Smith and executive produced by Darren Aronofsky and Newtopia. An elite ensemble of astronauts tells the unexpected and unprecedented story of Earth, filmed across 900,000 plus miles, 45 countries, 6 continents, and outer space. Emmy eligible in all categories. Visit natgeotv.com/FYC for more information. Don't just consider. Explore.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today is Thursday, and that means we're getting ready to send out our weekly newsletter. It's a great way to stay current with what we're covering on the show. We'll also send you headlines from the wider world of arts, entertainment, and culture. You can sign up and get it at theframe.org/newsletter. And now a new film that captured our attention. It's called Boundaries. It's part road trip movie, part family dramedy. It stars Vera Farmiga as a single mom who compulsively saves dogs and is trying to set boundaries with her wayward drug-dealing father, played by Christopher Plummer.
you can drive your own trucks around from now on.
Hey, whoa.
You know what?
Whoa.
And find your own ride to L.A. because we are done.
You're really acting crazy. It's you that's going to get us the rest of
it. You are selfish. You are absolutely incapable of putting anyone else before yourself.
Maybe you could be happier if you did the same. I mean, you wouldn't be so goddamn miserable all the time.
Grandpa.
Don't stay out of this fight. Your mother has lost all rational thought.
Don't tell me how to feel. You don't get to tell me anything anymore.
Boundaries was written and directed by Shauna Feste, and the inspiration came from her relationship with her own father, who is both charismatic and a criminal. When Feste joined me in studio, she described what it was like growing up with a dad who was often doing illegal things.
I pretty much thought it was normal. You know, like, I've written letters for my brothers, for my father, when they've gone to prison, you know, those letters that family members write saying, please don't lock my dad up or whatever. You know, this is, he's such an amazing man. I've written those letters at a very early age.
To judges begging for clemency or
exactly.
Begging for a lighter sentence.
Yeah. And, you know, my father, I remember, you know, the day that I, you know, had to make a presentation at school about what my father did for a living. And I just said, oh, my father bets on football games. And that's what he was doing at the time. He was a bookie. But that was totally normal for me. And it was totally normal that we had, like, you know, this paper where he would write things down. And if you spilled water on it, it disintegrated. And we thought that was just so much fun. But that's where he'd write all his secrets and his bets and all his business stuff.
So that they would be lost in case somebody ever raided the house and started looking for stuff.
Yeah, but my sister and I thought it was so cool. That was like a magic trick.
When you were starting to write Boundaries and thinking about the things that happened to you and the things that you need to create to tell the story, are some of the things that happened to you beyond creating that they're almost too crazy to be believed? Do you have to persuade some people, like, this isn't fiction, this actually happened? And if so, what were some of the things that happened that were almost too strange for fiction?
Well, I mean, so much of the movie I feel like is too strange. I mean, not strange to me.
Right.
You know, I sleep, my idea of heaven would be to sleep with 8 dogs in my bed. And I thought it was just really an awesome quality in Laura until we showed it the first time to a bigger audience and the cards were like horrified, just like, what normal woman would have so many animals in her disgusting home? Is she a hoarder? She needs to go into therapy. And I'm reading all these things that are really just about myself, I guess, and feeling very sad. But, you know, everything with my dad, the way he speaks in the film, you know, him trafficking that much marijuana, his relationship with my son, all based on, you know, things that have happened in our life.
Do you know why we're here?
To visit Stanley and his son?
That and?
I don't know. To annoy my mom?
I'm a drug dealer, Hoyt. I know I may look out of my prime, but I'm just getting started. There's $200,000 worth of weed in there. Go on, take a look.
Your father died a year ago, so he wasn't able to see this film.
Yeah.
But in terms of how it changed you, where it changed you in relationship to seeing your dad, and how audiences who don't know your dad might see or understand somebody like him in their own lives. How would you describe that?
Well, I think, you know, my father looks horrible on paper, right? You just read, like, his resume is bad. You know, in and out of prison, breaking the law, divorces, leaving families behind. But when you sit down and you meet him, and you know, drink tequila with him, and he tells you these stories, and you see the life in his eyes and his laugh, you don't judge him as harshly. And I think, you know, it's part of the reason that I would be a horrible jury member, you know, because I always have a soft spot for criminals. I don't think they never pick me, because it's more complicated than that, right? We're so complicated, and I love anti-heroes. So, I don't know, I hope people can open their heart a little more after watching this.
We're talking with Shauna Feste, the writer-director of the film Boundaries. Your character, played by Vera Farmiga, like yourself in real life, has a very strong connection to animals.
Yeah.
In fact, your dog Loretta has a starring role in the film. What did that grow out of? And for the people who judged this character's ties to pets, how would you explain it?
Well, I've always surrounded myself with animals from the time I was little. It's been very, very important to me. And I'm a huge animal rescuer. So actually, one of the reasons that I wanted to bring that part of me you know, into this movie is because I thought I was in the shelters, you know, every week, picking someone up, rehabilitating them, finding a foster home for them. And this was a huge amount of time that I spent doing this. But every time I would go back to the shelters, I would just see more and more dogs. It's just like an endless, bottomless pit of animals that need help. So I thought, I'm a filmmaker. If I can use this opportunity to shine a light on something I'm so passionate about, which is rescuing. Because rescuing for me, I think anyone who has had any kind of childhood trauma surrounds themselves with animals. It's a natural fit, you know? They are the ones that will never hurt you.
Right.
You know, they're all love. And they just give, 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 give. And it's unconditional love. And that's what I needed to do, to surround myself with that.
You are making this film around the time that you are becoming a parent yourself.
Yeah.
And this is really a movie about the relationship between a father and a child and the mother and a son. How do you start thinking about what this story says about parenting as you're in the middle of parenting yourself?
Well, I think that was kind of, you know, why I wanted to write about it, because when I started having kids, that's when I was able to get in touch with my anger, because I realized, how could you want to miss any of this? You know, I look at my son and I think, I don't want to miss a day. It's hard enough to go to work. So what was my dad thinking when he was gone for 3 months in Africa, 4 months without calling or knowing where he was? And so I think actually having Waylon and Ellis, Ellis was 3 months when I made this movie, really actually was a catalyst for writing this story, because it forced me to look at my own anger in a different way than I ever have before.
You are able to make this film with your husband, who is your producer, and with your children around during photography.
Yeah.
What was that like to be able to actually pack up your family and be with them in the middle of making a movie about a family?
Yeah. I don't know. It's such a tough thing being a working mom in this industry, because I feel like I haven't found my place yet, because when I'm just with my children, that doesn't feel totally right. And then when I'm just working and away from them, I miss them so much, that doesn't feel totally right. So I think I'm still trying to figure it all out. But having them there was the best of both worlds, because I just needed the support to make this film. And, you know, when I made The Greatest, when I made Country Strong, and I would come home from shooting and I was just immersed in this filmmaking world and I had no one there to kind of put me in my place. My kids put me in my place, you know? They make everything better.
Were there any days during filming where it was difficult for you to revisit something that had happened in your own life?
Yeah, I think that scene where she says, I spent my entire childhood scared. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that's really hard to go back to that, because I was scared a lot as a kid. And as much as I, you know, romanticize my father and say, you know, see the good in him, it's complicated because I was alone a lot when I was a little girl. And my mom was working really hard. And so she wasn't always there. And there are just a lot of moments where I could have used him. And I dated a lot of bad guys where I could have used a dad that was kind of more present and giving me a better example. And that's kind of a hard lesson that I had to figure out. So that scene when seeing Vera's raw emotion and then seeing Chris Plummer say, I'm sorry you were scared. Those are words I gave to my dad, but he never said them to me. I think as a writer, you know, you get to write these nice endings for yourself and try and heal some childhood trauma. So that was what I was trying to do. But yeah, watching that scene, yeah, it was difficult. And now I haven't been able to watch the movie.
Really?
No. I just, you know, he's in it and he, you know, has this moment where he beams into the camera and I'm just like all the saved voicemails I have on my phone where I haven't been able to listen to him quite yet. I just am scared of seeing him in the film.
and what that'll bring up.
Shauna, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, God, thank you so much for having me.
Shauna Feste is the writer and director of Boundaries. It's in theaters on June 22nd. Coming up, a feminist country group that takes inspiration from a World War II poster.
KPCC supporters include HBO, presenting Westworld. Live without limits in a world where every human appetite can be indulged. This dark odyssey follows the dawn of artificial consciousness and the evolution of sin. In this hit series, a group of android hosts deviate from their programmers' carefully planned scripts in a disturbing pattern of aberrant behavior. Chaos takes control in the second season of Westworld, Emmy eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
And now Rosie and the Riveters is a vocal group from Saskatchewan in Western Canada. They're inspired by folk, country, and 1940s jazz. The trio is made up of Alexis Norman, Allison Ray, and Faraday Olson, and they all share the lead vocals equally. Their group's name is a nod to the World War II Rosie the Riveter poster, whose We Can Do It slogan and buff bicep is a symbol for women's empowerment. Rosie and the Riveters' second album takes that a step further. Called Misbehave, it contains feminist anthems, including the band's response to the Me Too movement, the song I Believe You. They're donating a large portion of their proceeds to female causes around the world and organizations like RAIN, that's the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. The trio visited our studios and spoke with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett. Here's Rosie and the Riveters.
My name is Alexis Normand.
I'm Allison Ray.
And my name is Faraday Olson.
We are from Saskatchewan, the land of living skies, where the sky pretty much stretches out just like the ocean does.
There's nothing to do in Saskatchewan. As you know, it's above Montana and North Dakota. So there's a saying, you either play hockey or you play an instrument. And that's why there's so many musicians that are coming out of Saskatchewan.
I've curled up in an unmade bed so I wouldn't be alone. I've stopped myself from walking out just to have a home.
For this last record, Misbehave, we really wanted to do something really collaborative. So we secluded ourselves in a cabin in northern Saskatchewan and we pumped out the music.
We wrote a lot of bad songs, too. Yeah, there's a couple topics we needed to try more than once. And it wasn't until it was all done and we brought them to our producer that we realized we're actually pretty feminist.
If I dared to be a dragon with fire on my tongue.
So, we have a song about the gender pay gap. We have a song that supports survivors of sexual assault. There are many songs that I think just talk about what it's like to be a woman these days.
I dare have a vision. I dare raise my hand. Cause I want more than I'm given. So I burn, burn the plan. I wanna be king.
It's interesting when you look at like Loretta Lynn, the Pill, or like Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, and you're like, wow, there are these like feminist anthems deep in what I would consider like a very conservative kind of genre. But at the same time, I think it's been interesting performing our music in many markets. And in North Carolina, where we were like, ooh, I wonder how they're gonna feel about this. The women were really into it.
Well, I have been known to like a little rum.
Certainly has a lot of sassy attitude in there, and I think that's what we tried to translate vocally. You know, like the song starts off with super sassy, you know, it's really fun. Even just the syllable mm, like there's so much that could be said in a mm. It could be a loving mm, it could be a savoring mm, but this one's like don't mess with me.
So Misbehave sort of was an idea that I had floating around in my head, and I really liked the idea of challenging the status quo of women and like, I'm going to behave the way I want to. And you know, when someone says you need to behave like a lady, I say, however I behave is like a lady because I am a lady.
You got to behave. So I'll misbehave. Behave. I'll behave in my grave. There's lots of sinners. I don't care what they say. What they
part of our creative challenge too, mm-hmm. deciphering when and how to be funny and witty, and when and how to be heartfelt and sensitive, mm-hmm. and choosing our approach appropriately depending on what we're talking about.
I believe you when they ask what did you wear. I believe you when you say you were scared.
Well, we wrote I Believe You in February of 2017, so this was before the Me Too movement went viral. And it was really just drawing upon our own experiences and the stories of our friends, and I'd come across three words that are really important to share with individuals who are going through this experience. So that's kind of where we started. I said, why don't we write a song called I Believe You?
You know, something that speaks to a greater conversation. Like Faraday said, Tarana Burke began the Me Too movement over 10 years ago, so it's something that, you know, we're finally talking about in our society and on a larger scale in our culture. And that doesn't mean that disclosing is easier necessarily, but it's certainly something that more people are being aware of. And specifically for the song I Believe You, we've chosen to donate all monies collected from streaming and download sales. And in Canada, we've partnered with the YWCA of Canada, so we're giving them all that money that's generated through streaming and download. And then in the States, we're donating that money to RAIN. As we've performed it for audiences across North America, a lot of people have really connected to that song and will reach out, you know, on social media, in our email, in person at shows, and just say thank you for that message, because we live in a society that puts the onus of an assault on the survivor.
As a songwriter, I always hope that our music connects with people, and to see it connect on that level is something empowering as a songwriter. You know, we have this goal to be empowering, and it's sort of like the energy is being reciprocated.
I believe you. There's no need to explain. I believe you when they slander your name. Please don't forget you're not alone.
And that'll do it for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.